speaker comes all the way from Telford, and we really appreciate him driving from the long-distance trip here. I've known Brian for a while. I watched him early on in recovery, and it's just been awesome to see how this program helps us to grow and change and become a channel of God's light. So if you'd help me welcome Brian.
My name's Brian. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, we change. We get grayer and balder, and that's what happens to me. Thanks the group for asking me to come out tonight and share my experience, strength, and hope. It's been a while, I've spoken quite a bit. I've been sober about 11 and a half years and spoken a lot, but there's been a lull in the action. So I brought my wife along. She can check my facts, make sure I'm being accurate, as I let you guys know what happened in my life and how things are now. There was something my home group meets here on Saturday mornings at 8:30. It's a big book meeting, and we read the whole book, which means we get to read the stories too. And the first part of the book, the first 187 pages, which is 164 plus the doctor's opinion and the preface and all that, tells us about the program of recovery. But especially in the early days of AA, I think those stories in the back of the book were like exhibit A through Z about how the program works. And there's a lot of good information to be gleaned from that. They didn't have the benefit of speakers always back in those days, and the book was a primary way to see that the program worked. I mean, you could tell me something works, but if I don't see it work in people's lives, like, why would I believe it? You know, I'm somebody you have to show something to repeatedly a lot of times before I get it. But there was something in this. We read the last story, so we're going to be coming around, wrapping around again to start the book over again. But the last story, it said, AA is not here to help me handle my drinking. It's here to help me handle my sobriety. And if you're early and new and that doesn't make any sense, just hang around. It will at some point. As I share my story, I'll talk a little bit about what I realized. Part of my spiritual awakening, which was not sunlight coming through the window and shining on my face. It was basically, as the appendix in the book says, it was just a way I started to look at things differently in this world. A change came over me as a result of this program and letting God into my life, and it helped me look at things differently. And so there were little moments along the way. I don't know if you've ever been to a ball game and you look at the big lights that come on at the game, and really they're lights made up of a whole bunch of lights, you know, and you don't really realize when the lights come on in the stadium. That's how my spiritual experience was. One light would come on at a time, and before I knew it, the lights were pretty bright, but it did take a while. They had to delay the ball game quite a while before I got what was going on. But anyway, I will share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. There's some blank pages in the big book. My story is in the big book because I wrote it in the blank pages in the book. So if you want your story to be in the big book, go ahead and write on the blank pages. The first time I was asked to speak at a meeting, I was like 5 months sober. They always ask the new people. I don't know if they do that everywhere, but around here, 90 days or so, they start to push you with a stick and say, you're going to speak at the next meeting. I don't know if it's, if they get glee from watching you go through your car wreck. But I don't think it's that. I think it's more that, it gives you the opportunity to kind of shine some light on some of the horrible things that have gone on in your life. And I remember preparing for that first time speaking. I spent about 3 days writing 13 pages of notes. Boy, was I going to wow the crowd with that, you know? And I don't think once I got started, I think it just came from the heart. I don't think I ever looked at that again. And that's what I'm hoping happens tonight. Like I said, I was a little bit nervous, but, we can work through that. I got sober. My sobriety date's the 15th of January, 2007. So by the grace of God, the fellowship and the 12 steps of AA, I've been sober for 11 and a half years or so. It's hard to believe that sometimes. I've known some people here who were there 30, 60, 90 days and still around and alive and kicking. But I got sober on a Monday, and the 15th of January was Martin Luther King Day. It was a Monday. And I'll fill in a little of the backstory. I think it's important. I have respect for people who speak at meetings, always do. But I hear some people speak and they say, I'm not going to bore you with the details. You've all drank before. I'm not going to do my drunk log. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But even Bill's story, the first 8 pages of Bill's story talk about what it was like. And I think it's really important to be able to identify with somebody talking about alcoholism. If I get right into the program recovery, I haven't identified as an alcoholic. It comes off sometimes as this person's just a know-it-all and they just skipped right to getting better, like what happened to that stuff that got them there. So I'm going to try to cover some of that with some brevity. I'm not going to regale you with tales of how wonderful it was, because it wasn't wonderful toward the end, that's for sure. In fact, I don't know really how wonderful it ever was. Felt wonderful at times, but did a lot of damage. But anyway, it was a Monday, and my son and I were living in an apartment together. He was 16 years old. I have a daughter who's now 24 and a son who's 28, but my daughter wasn't living with me, wanted nothing to do with me. And my son and I lived in an apartment in Souderton. It was in a place called Chestnut Hill Condominiums. And if you've ever seen the place, there's nothing condominium about it. It was a one-bedroom apartment with the air conditioner falling out of the window, and that's where we lived. But it was a Monday. I didn't have a driver's license or a car, because not having a driver's license never stopped me from driving, but not having a car will stop you from driving. I came home from work. I rode my bike to work. I happened to have a job, managed to have a job. Came home on that Monday, and I started drinking. By the end, I was a daily drinker. Drank in the morning, drank in the evening, drank every chance I could get. So I came home and started drinking, and was working on that nightly drink, or that buzz that came with the nightly drink. And my son was in the bedroom, and he was playing music too loud or breathing too loud, or something was going on that was bothering me. And I'm an angry guy. When I'm an angry guy all the time, or was an angry guy all the time, but when I drank, boy, all that stuff that's in there came to the top, and he was pissing me off for some reason. So I went in the bedroom, or I headed for the bedroom with a buzz, and I remember going through the doorway, and the door was broken because I had kicked it in the week before, because how dare he lock a door? And he was probably locking it because he was sick of my business, but I remember walking through that doorway, and he and I got into a little discussion about what was going on, and I say discussion very loosely, and it got heated rather fast. Now, my son at this point is 16. He's taller than I am. And he's probably had enough of my crap since the time he was little. And we went at it. He put his hands around my throat. And since we're being recorded and I try to be spiritual most of the time, I won't use the F word, but it was in there. And he said, "Why don't you just quit drinking? And you can put the F word wherever you want, as an adjective or a verb or whatever you want to do." But it was in there, and he was angry. Later talking to him, he said it was he was the most scared he's ever been in his life to say that. But when he said it, I had no answer for it. I don't know. I'm sure people had asked me or suggested I quit drinking in my life, although most people stayed out of my life, and if they didn't, I pushed them out of my life. But I had no answer for them that day about why I didn't just stop drinking. But so I left the room. He dropped his hands from my throat. He had his hands firmly around my throat, and he dropped his hands, and I left the room. And I cried, and I cried plenty when I drank, whether it was because what the world has done to me, or everything that's been taken from me, or how people treat me, or I was in trouble, because I'll fill in a few spots where I was in trouble in a jam because of my drinking. I cried. But this time I did something different. I actually took an action. I picked up the phone and called 215-721-3656, and that's a hotline number for this district, which Quakertown is part of. And I got that number out of the phone book, and it's an old joke, but it always brings a chuckle, is that AA is very easy to find in the phone book. It's right in the beginning. I didn't have to go searching very far. And I called and asked for help. Now, I have never asked for help for anything in my life. I was taught not to as a child. I kept everything to myself. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I was in the Army for 12 years. You don't admit defeat to anything. If you can't solve a problem, you haven't tried hard enough. And that was the mindset I was always in. And but this time I asked for help. Now, the person who answered the phone asked for my name and number, and I gave it to him, and they hung up. And I said, "That's not very helpful at all." And, "That's it? Okay. Well, what happens is they take your information, and somebody calls you back off of a list. I've been a volunteer on that list and taken many of those calls since. But a gentleman called me back. Ends up, he lived about a half a mile from my house. He's since passed away, but he was an old codger, cantankerous, whatever you want to say. He was a pain in the ass a lot of the time, but he saved my life that night. And I beg to differ with people say you shouldn't talk to somebody when they're drunk. As long as they're not belligerent and throwing things at you, I think you could talk to him. Because if he wouldn't have talked to me that night, I was drunk. If he wouldn't have talked to me that night, if he would have said, call me back when you haven't been drinking, I don't know if I would ever called anybody. Then I don't know if you've ever had that next day where you've had that night before and there's all that guilt and pity and remorse. And the next day you wake up. And for me, I wake up and say, well, how bad was it? You know, it's a new day. I'll tighten the bootstraps. I'll get to it. And it'll be different this time. But he talked to me, and I don't really know what he said. He wasn't a big spiritual 12-step person, but I know what he did say to me that night was, stop drinking tonight, pour out what you have, go to bed, go to work tomorrow, and I'll pick you up for a meeting tomorrow night. And that was enough. I poured out. I had half a Busch Light, which is a sad way to end your drinking career. Rest in peace, Anheuser-Busch. But that was the last. I've never poured out a drink in my life. I drink the stuff other people are going to pour out. If you've ever been around 1:58 a.m. and you're running around the tables looking for stuff that people left, because an average person, even if they're up at 2 a.m., they leave what they've got left on the table. Well, I poured out that drink and have never had to pick up it. By the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to pick up a drink since. And at times, most of the time, that's been a miracle. And one I am grateful for. But so that what that guy told me that night was enough to get me to the next day. And as much of a miracle as that Monday was, I think the Tuesday was even more of a miracle, because with no alcohol in my body, I stood outside and waited for a man I've never met to take me to a place I've never been to address a problem I've never addressed in my life. And it would have been easy not to answer the door. You need a security code to get my, why you needed a code to get in this building, I don't know. It was probably to keep people in and not people out. But something had broken, I guess. And what that guy had told me the night before, I think it was just that I wasn't alone anymore. And he picked me up, picked me up at 6:30 for an 8:30 meeting. I was like, why are we here so early? You know, but that's what started sobriety. My first meeting was on a Tuesday night. I raised my hand and said I was an alcoholic. That was enough to get me to Wednesday, and that was in Percocet, and Thursday was at Penn Foundation, and Friday was at the hospital in Quakertown, and Saturday was Penn Foundation, and so on. Those early days, I really lived it a day at a time. I did go to work. I'd come home from work. Somebody picked me up to go to a meeting. I'd eat something, go to bed, and repeat cycle for quite a while. And that it went like that for – I did everything that I was told to do. I saw steps. They're over here someplace. I saw those on the wall. They probably should hide those from newcomers because it's some scary crap down there at the bottom. Making amends. Like, I'm trying to avoid those people. Why would I go find them? Spiritual awakenings and writing inventories and stuff. They probably should just dole out the steps one at a time for new people. But they were on the wall, and I was like, immediately, I have a college degree. Before my drinking got bad, I was actually a student and a soldier and a bunch of other happy stuff. But so I figured, well, what are you going to have to do about those steps? Are you going to have to learn them? And it's nice to memorize them. I mean, it's nice to know them. You know, if they're not hanging, people, you'll come in handy at a meeting if somebody forgot the steps and they're wondering what they are. But there's really, it's a program of living, and that didn't come till later. But so I came to meetings and listened and did what they said, and that lasted me till I was about 6 months sober. I think, Rich, that's about when we met, right? July 2007. I'll try not to get choked up. But so what was happening at 6 months sober is that I was without a drink, and my head was spinning, like out of control. Like, I didn't realize how much the drinking had kept quiet in my head until it was gone. And I would go to a lot of places. I'm a fan of just don't drink. Or, you know, I don't drink, so I'm a fan of that. But everybody kept telling me what not to do. And I'm sure people talked about the steps. I heard the guy speak 2 weeks ago. He said, I'm sure they were talking about the 12 steps. I know this meeting was. I came to this meeting pretty early. And but I was hearing just don't drink. And I got tired of them telling me what not to do. Like, I know not to drink. Like, but how is that going to happen? Like, am I going to have to hide in AA meetings for the rest of my life? I didn't know. I thought maybe they'd have to lock the doors. Like, I don't know how hard and how bad you drank, but alcohol was a part of my life every minute of every day. And all of a sudden you're saying, just don't do that. Okay, I won't do that. Now what am I going to do? So about 6 months sober, a gentleman came to our meeting, and a Tuesday night meeting, and he spoke. And he was very plain about what he spoke about, but he spoke about being happy and being sober. And it's kind of like what I talked about, that story telling me at the beginning of the meeting, was that how do I handle sobriety? And that's what he talked about, is about a way of living where you can be happy and sober. I hadn't been sober in a long time before this 6 months, but I hadn't been happy in a long, long time. If I'm honest with myself, there hadn't been happiness in my moments. I mean, I was there for the birth of my daughter, and I was there, like, I get promoted in the military, and like, there were moments, but as far as true happiness from the soul, like, I hadn't had that in a long time, and I liked what he had to say, because, I think, I don't know, you watch a hamster run on a wheel, it really doesn't matter how, able-bodied and strong the hamster is, I think the wheel's gonna win eventually, and that's where I was at with sobriety. So, he had some ideas, and then he also added, he said, I need to help people, not me personally, he needed to help people, and he had just been sponsoring somebody, hadn't worked out, but it was incumbent upon him to sponsor people in this program, so, I was in need of a sponsor. He needed somebody to sponsor. It was love at first sight. You know, I wish I could say that. It took a while for my feet to warm. That I had asked other men to sponsor me. I had been turned down 3 times for sponsorship, which that's enough to make you want to drink for sure. I would say to you now, if you can't sponsor somebody, try to have an alternative for them, because it's possible not to be able to sponsor people, but try to have something for him. But I'm glad to this day that was the person that came across my path. And he showed me in the book. Imagine that. There's a book that they give away most meetings that has a program of recovery in it. And I had read the book. I was given a book on February 2nd. So was I sober about 2.5 weeks. Was given a book by that same gentleman that took me to my first meeting. And I read it. It was pretty, baffling, most of it. I thought the jaywalker was amusing, you know, the way he ran in front of the fire truck and all that. I was like, what an idiot, you know? And then they say, now replace the jaywalking with drinking. And I'm like, oh, I'm the idiot, you know? So I thought parts of it were interesting. I thought, you know, that's great. They got this doctor who had an opinion. Yeah, I've got opinions too, you know? People don't always welcome those, but, and what I found out is what this program is about sitting down with that material with another man. Somebody who has been through it with another man, who's been through it with another man. And ultimately it traces back to the people who started this program. And if you're a historian of AA, it traces back further than that. You know, helping people, making inventories, admitting your faults to others, making amends, those things have been around for a long time. And those guys that started this program kind of just brought it together and said one alcoholic with another alcoholic, that's what this program's about. So that's what happened. And life started to change a little bit. Not right away. It wasn't magical. I still remember being here on a Saturday morning, and I couldn't be trusted by the bank or the world with a checking account. So I went to the bank on Saturday morning and got money out from my savings account to pay my bills. So I have a wallet in my back pocket with about $400 in it, which at the time, it's a lot of money any day, to have in your wallet. But, I went and waited for this guy to pick me up to bring me to Saturday morning meeting. And we got here, my wallet was gone out of my pocket. And he tried to give me some lesson in acceptance for that. I was not having it. All I could do was think about, I had lost everything I had and what was I going to do? But I started to learn something that day. And that's how this program worked. It just started to happen for me a little bit at a time. And there were a lot of wonderful people that I came across. And the way I looked at things started to change. You know, being powerless over something, while it was not easy to admit, the first 80-some pages, 63 pages, and the 20-some Roman numeral pages, that whole time in that book is to really smash home the fact that I need to admit to myself that I'm an alcoholic. Now, that might sound, I'm an AA, of course I'm an alcoholic, but it's really not that simple. That material at the beginning of the book talks about looking at yourself and checking your drinking and the things that need to happen in our lives to admit that, because without step one, there's no foundation for step two. And eventually 12 comes, but I think one leads to two and two leads to three. So if I'm powerless, there must be a power. There's people sober everywhere. There's got to be a power that restores us to sanity. What's insane? It's acting the way I act, the way my drinking is. It doesn't mean I'm in a straitjacket, although it can. But it means that I'm insane and I need to make a decision and so on. But I'll go back a little bit. I try to go back and fill in what it was like, what I was like before. And I'll keep an eye on the clock closely so I'm not, don't go over. But, I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father died from this disease. Jesus, 2 years. The funeral was 2 years from tomorrow, I think. And I grew up with that. He was an angry drunk. There was a lot of violence in my home. A lot of, emotional violence, it was just a bad place to be. I couldn't wait to leave when I was 18. But, so I grew up with that, and you know, logic says you grow up watching that and being around that experience and that you'll never want to be that in your life. And I certainly didn't want to be that. But who does, you know, and I know around 16, I'm a teenager and I was invited to a party. I was an introvert, didn't have a lot of friends. I was invited to a party and there was drinking involved. And I was like, I said, I'll take part in it. And I did, like, and I drank like an alcoholic. I needed a meeting after that first time. I'll tell you that. I drank like all night. I drank longer and harder than anybody else that night. I remember going to bed and I was staying over at my friend's house and he said, whatever you do, don't throw up in my sleeping bag. And, guess what I did? And not just in his sleeping bag, but on the floor and on the way to the bathroom and the bathroom and so on. But when that cleared up a day or two later, I just remember that feeling about fitting in and being part of and feeling like I finally belonged to something. And I chased that for the rest of my life. I know it's been said many times, but I can feel that feeling. Even today, I can feel that feeling, what it felt like to be part of something. But that scared me off for a while. That sickness that came, I was sick for 2 or 3 days afterwards. And it wasn't until around 18 when I drank again. And it was fun. You know, I had a good time with it. I didn't smash and burn the first time or the second time or the third time. And it started to become part of my life. Not a big part. I was going to college and then, I decided I didn't like college too much and I joined the military and I was doing the right things, but it was starting to creep in there. And if anybody's been in the military, I don't know what it's like today, but it was a drink fest when I was in. Like that's how you made your bones as a man. That's how you showed. And I'm 18 years old and these guys are inviting me out and there's no drinking age on base. And I just drank like there was no tomorrow, but everybody else did too. You know, if we got in trouble, it was together. If we did something stupid, it was everybody. How much stupid things sound so much more fun when you're doing them with other people. And that's how it went. Again, like the warning signs were there. You know, I got my first DUI when I was 19 years old, not even legal to drink. Got my second one when I was 21. Got my third one when I was 23. Got my fourth one. How about it? Collecting them. And they were all in different states too. So I can tell you all about DUI laws in 4 different states. But early on, like, there was a problem. But again, like, I wasn't losing enough stuff and I still had this and that and the other thing. I don't know, somewhere around 23, I met my wife. She was married to my best friend at the time when I met her. So drunk, then I decided I really liked her a lot. And we ended up together, and had 2 kids from that. Yeah. Every relationship I ever had till I married my wife was started off with drinking. That was my experience with relationships, but I met her, broke my friend's heart. I didn't care. I remember he came home and saw us sitting on the couch together. Luckily it was just rated PG business and we were sitting on the couch, but, he came home and he was my friend, you know, or what I considered a friend, and he saw us. And I remember I cried because I thought I was going to get in trouble because the military cares about that kind of stuff. And I was crying, not because I broke my friend's heart, or did irreparable damage to his marriage or anything. I was crying because I thought I was going to get in trouble. So somewhere around there, I think I was 23, my wife and I, my first wife and I got married, had my son, who's 28 now. My drinking really went away for a while. I went back to college. I got into distance running. Whenever I drank, I drank like an alcoholic, but I could tell myself I was an alcoholic because I didn't drink that often. You know, I would go months and weeks and months and I would without drinking. But that marriage went, we had another child, but that marriage eventually withered on the vine and died. It was crazy. It was a chaos mess from the beginning. But when I got divorced, I took it really hard, and that marriage needed to end when it did. But I think I took it as like a failure on my part as a human being, as a man. I tried to hang on to that. And when I lost it, I ended up with custody of the two kids and no adult supervision. And my drinking really started up. Now, my kids needed me. They needed a parent 100%, 24/7. And I couldn't give them any of that. Like, I gave them some of what a parent's supposed to be, but the drinking is what I needed to get through the days. And so I started to drink more regularly, and I started to get in trouble more regularly. And eventually, like the Army and I got honorable discharge, but I was out. I was always just ahead of the trouble by the skin of my teeth. And I managed to get out of the military. I learned a good trade. It's a trade I still practice today. But I got out of the service with 12 years in the military. And I moved to this area. I lived in Quakertown, got my last DUI in Quakertown. It was New Year's Day at 2:00 in the morning, and I'm driving through Coopersburg. You should just hang a sign on your car that says, "Please pull me over." Kind of, what's the speed limit? And like 2 miles an hour or something in Coopersburg. And I told the guy, the cop pulled me over, into the gas station. He pulled me over and he said, "I need you to step out of the vehicle." And I said, "If we're going to do the field sobriety test, I'd rather not." I said, I'm drunk. Just take me with you and take me to wherever you got to take me. So we forewent the field sobriety test, and I was taken away. So, my dad, you know, ironically, in a horrible way, the only number I knew was to call my dad. He probably was drunk when he picked me up. I don't know, but, he came and picked me up from the jail or from the DUI center and took me home, and then he wouldn't leave my house for like 3 days. I don't know if you thought he had to keep an eye on me or take care of me, but I couldn't get rid of him fast enough because I wanted to drink again, of course. So those are the kind of things that happen. My license was suspended. You're supposed to just go to DUI classes. I drank when I went to those and then didn't go to them anymore. And who really needs a driver's license to drive a car? I mean, you got keys in a car. You know, that's all you really need. So I drove for 3.5 years without a driver's license because I couldn't be bothered to take care of the problems that I had created. Meanwhile, my kids are getting older. It's crazy. I'm drinking in the car. I'm smashing the empties and putting them in the little pocket where you put your maps and stuff in the side pocket of the car. I'm violent to my son. Just the same. I was the same brutality that my dad had with me. I was physically and emotionally violent with my son. Nothing to be proud of. I feel bad for the things I did. But that's the escalation that was going on. I was drinking in the mornings. I could not make it. I could not get out of bed without drinking. I was coming apart at the seams. I couldn't make it to work without drinking on the way to work. I don't know how I made it through a work day, except I guess to look forward to the drink after work. And that's how every day went. Repeat, repeat. Finally, I got caught for driving with that suspended license twice in 3 days by the same cop on the same road. If you've heard the story, you know what's coming next. The second time he pulled me over, he said, "You know, there's more than one road to New Jersey." And I guess he was rooting for me there. I don't know. But that didn't stop me. Eventually, I was supposed to go to court. I didn't do any of that. They got tired of waiting for me and sent the sheriff's department out, and they took me away in front of my kids in handcuffs. That was 2005. If you're watching a movie, a made-for-TV movie or whatever, that's the light that shines through and gets you sober. Bill's story says the mind's a marvelous mechanism, because for 2 more years, I did the same stuff, and that's what happened to me. Got drunk the day I got out of jail. I drank in jail. I drank when they gave you work release. I went up the street to Uno's and drank 2 tall beers, got sent back to Big People Jail. Like, it just went on like that. Like, it's, you know, I can look back at it now. It holds some gallows humor in it, but it was a sad, pitiful life. But I had gotten to the point where I had no choice in whether I drank or not. The book talks about it, too, and the people you talk to in AA. I had ceased being a luxury and become a necessity. I could not live life without drinking. Now, to somebody who's not an alcoholic, that makes no sense. In fact, they would turn their nose at you and say, "I don't understand what you're talking about." But you guys understand what that's about, and that's why I feel at home in AA. So life went on like that. I went to jail for 173 days, got drunk the day I got out, decided I was going to go move to Mississippi and co-parent my kids, whose mom had to come and get them. I drank like nobody's business. Promised my kids I wouldn't drink. That's worse than not drinking, is promising them that you're not going to drink, because that I couldn't keep that promise. My daughter saw me walking from a convenience store one day carrying a 12-pack of beer, and I was walking by this little skinny Charlie Brown tree, and I tried to put the 12-pack behind the tree so she wouldn't see it. Didn't work. She saw it, and I broke her heart again. And it took a long time to mend our relationship. But that's the kind of stuff that went on. I moved to Wisconsin. I was going to help out family. I don't know if you've ever helped out family as a drunk. I helped myself to their money. My mom, she was working as a waitress. I'm doing nothing for occupation except sitting around the house. And my mom was working as a waitress, busting her butt. And I would go into her wallet at night and steal money out of her wallet. When Bill talks about stealing money out of Lois's wallet, I was doing that to my own mom. I remember trying to take ones and fives because she might not miss them. I remember accidentally taking 20s sometimes. I didn't return them. I just felt worse about it than taking the fives and the ones. But I've made amends since for that. Anyway, that went on. Life was a disaster. I got hit by a minivan in December of 2006 in Satterton. I was riding my bicycle drunk. I crossed my road. I know one thing. If you're driving around town and you see guys riding bicycles and they're wearing work boots and flannel shirts, they're probably not out for exercise. They probably cannot drive a car anymore, because that was me driving around on a bike. But I crossed traffic in Satterton, got splattered by a minivan, and the first thing I did is jump up off the sidewalk. And when the police came, I told them I was okay. Now I'm bleeding from the head. My knee is swollen twice its size, and I talked myself out of medical assistance. Not because I'm a homeopathic kind of guy, home remedy kind of guy, but I figured they were going to take blood, and I was going to go to jail. And I walked home, and the first thing I did when I got in the apartment was drank every bit of alcohol that was in the house. With a brain injury, with a concussion, I drank every bit of alcohol that was in the house. And that's how it led up. That was December of 2006. Few more weeks of that, dragging through the mud and feeling horrible about myself. And that miracle day in January came of 2007. So, what happened after I met my sponsor and we started to go through these 12 steps, I started to feel this change. Again, it was not drastic and rapid, but it was something that happened over time. And, I started to feel a little bit better about things. I put that stuff on paper and we sat down, and I don't remember a lot about that day. It was a long day. We were outside at a pavilion, outdoors. And I remember one thing he said. I went through this stuff, and I was indignant. Like, these are the people I resented, because I wish it was just like a three-column list. Because who am I resentful at? What did they do to me? And what it affected me? Like, I like that part. I'm going to tell you who pissed me off in this world. This is great. I'm going to write it down. And I just remember him saying to me, like, So let me get this straight. You're waiting for an apology from every person you've ever met in this world. And I was like, it seemed pretty silly, but I guess that's what I was waiting for. And finally, it started dawn on me that I had a part in things. I had read it in the book, but really experiencing it with another person. And I was able to share that stuff out. How do I stop being this person that I am now? I asked God into my life. And was that easy to do? Not at all. I didn't know what God was. I still have problems sometimes. It's funny because they say if you want to write down what God is, make sure you write it in pencil, because it's probably going to change over the course of your spiritual life. I've been to Buddhist retreats. I've been to Quaker meeting houses. I've been to Scientology, like scientific conferences. I've had times where I cursed God. I had times where I doubted the existence of God. But I've always come back to knowing that there's something bigger than me in the universe. There is a God, and I'm not God. And that's basically what the third step tells you. So that led me into, you know, going through four and five and then trying to invite God into my life. Help me not be this person. Well, how am I not going to be selfish? I've got to be selfless. And that was around the time when my sponsor said it was incumbent I help other people. And I said, but I haven't been through the 12 steps yet. Well, this guy asked me to sponsor him at Penn Foundation, and my sponsor said, you have something to share with them. Share what you have, and we'll get to the rest of the steps in the meantime. And that was my experience at sponsoring somebody was at 8 months sober. Not everybody's experience, but I'll tell you this, to this day, 90% of what I've gotten out of sobriety has been from helping other people. It just, It's this program in action. There's no better way to reflect on what my defects are than to sit down with another person and talk about theirs. There's no better way to motivate me to do amends than to talk about another person and say, these are the people you need to make things right with. And so that's what started to happen. I started to have these other people come, and they came like droves. Like, I don't know what the heck was going on. I was like, that's enough of that. And I found out later in life it is possible to sponsor too many people, especially when you start to have issues in recovery. I found out that there's plenty of demons to slay in this world. There's a lot to learn about myself, and I've disappointed some sponsees who thought that I think I used to put myself up on a pedestal unconsciously, but I used to say, like, this is what you need to do, that's what you need to do, and then at times I've had struggles practicing those things in my life. So I'm a lot more on an even plane with whoever I work with now. But somewhere around there, while I started sponsoring men, I was making amends, and I want to make sure I have time to mention a couple of those, because those are miracles. Like, step four, when you put it on paper, that feels good. Like, that felt good to me because it was an action. Like, I don't know about sharing it with somebody else. That's five. But I'm writing it on paper. I'm doing that. And then some of the realizations that came when I wrote it, I was ready to share it with another man. And that takes a lot of, it takes courage. It takes humility and courage. And that's from God. I got that, but I shared it. Then maybe things aren't so bad. Like, somebody knows my stuff, and they love me anyway, and maybe God loves me too. But you come up to step eight, and you start to make a list of people you harm. First of all, I needed a lot of paper to make this list, because there were a lot of people on that list. But then when it comes time to go forward and take this list forward into the world, it really is an exhibit to how God is working in your life. And for me, going forward to those people, I remember the first amends, like, I don't know, the order you should do them. You do them as they become available, but I was in Satterton, and I was, if you know Satterton, there's a big dip in the middle of Satterton. You walk up this hill, and I was walking up the hill because I still didn't have my license, and I was going to Wawa, and I saw, I had a girlfriend at one time, and I ended up living with her before I got sober, stole her car, slept in an abandoned building. I left that whole thing out. We'll come back another time, and we'll talk about that. But I saw her outside the Wawa, and everything in me said, this is my chance to make amends to this woman. I wronged her. I stole from her. I did all these things to her. So what I did is I ran and hid behind the Satterton Municipal Building. I was not doing that. And I called my sponsor from behind, from the darkness of the municipal building, and I felt ashamed, you know, and what he said to me that day, in not so many words, was that, don't worry about it. It wasn't time for that yet. Just move forward. And later on, I was able to make things right with that person. And that was a wonderful thing. There have been a lot of great amends. I made amends to a landlord. I tortured my landlord in Quakertown for years. Imagine this. He comes to collect the rent. First of all, he would like me to deliver the rent to him. Well, we were not having that. So he would have to come around the fifth of the month and start knocking on the door for the rent. And most of the time, I would tell the kids to be quiet while he's out there knocking on the door. And then around the 10th or the 15th or whatever. Like, I just owed him, you know, and I figured that's too bad to him. But later on, I made the approach and went to the office he was at. And sure enough, he wasn't in the office, but his wife was. And she said, oh, right now he's working at your old apartment, so you can just go over there and talk to him. So I had to go to my old house, and there's my landlord there, my ex-landlord, and I've got to talk to him about this. But I did. But by that time, the amends had started to roll. There was momentum in that, spiritual momentum in that. And those things started to happen. And I was able to make things right with my daughter, make things right with my brother, make things right with my ex-wife. My son, I was sober. God, I don't know how long I was sober. Not even a year. And my son tried to commit suicide. And he took too many pills. They took him to the hospital. And I went to the hospital. By this, we're not really having any kind of relationship yet at this time. But I remember sitting outside the hospital and thinking, should I call his mom or not? Now, what a horrible thing to think, that should I call his mom or not? And when I asked myself why I was having a problem with that, it was because I was afraid that she would look at me as a bad parent. Not that her son had done anything, but how it would look on me. And I had been taught that that's not the way we look at the world. I called her, and she was in the car the next day, and she drove. And she actually stayed, her and her aunt stayed in my apartment, and I was able to make amends to her while we could be at my son's bedside together. The next year, same thing happened with my daughter, and she called me, and I flew to Mississippi that night, and I was there with her to be there for our children. And that's the power that amends gives. It leads into 10, 11, and 12. Like, I know I've got a little bit of time, and I don't want to short shirk any of the steps, but 10, 11, and 12 is really where we live life. Am I doing everything on a daily basis that I need to do? Am I doing an inventory on a daily? How was my day? Where was I selfish? So full of anger? Where was I resentful? Where was I full of fear? Those are the things I need to ask myself every day. Some days are better than others. You know, I've had some dark times in sobriety. I've been married 10 years now. I didn't know how to be married. It was a great idea. I'm blessed to be married to the person I'm married to today, but I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what being honest was. I didn't know what being intimate was. And a lot of it's been learned on the job, and it's been through a lot of trial and tribulation. I put this person through a lot, but I've learned a lot about myself in that. If I would have done those inventories every day, probably wouldn't have been as bad. You know, might have had a little easier time with that. But so doing those things on a daily basis. 11, improving my conscious contact with God as I understood Him. What does that mean? For me, it means making sure I'm in contact with something in the universe. Right now, I'm going to Calvary Church. I'm not doing a commercial for any church. This is just where I go. I go to Calvary Church in Satterton, and every couple weeks I go to Lutheran Church in Telford, sometimes on the same Sunday. So I'm really getting it from both ends. I take my mom, who's moved back to this area, the same mom that I stole from. She moved back to the area so I could help take care of her. I take her to church on Sundays. I don't do that because I want to look like a great guy. I do it because my mom deserves that. But to get back to it, I'm going to church. Sometimes I'm catching the God's sun rays from all different directions. You know, for a while I was going through a time when I was complicating God. Can ask my wife. She got tired of hearing me question God's existence. I started to think, like, maybe I'm thinking about it too much. Maybe I should just feel that feeling again that comes inside with being useful to other people. And it's a good life now because of that. Step 12, I talked a little bit about it, but it's been a wonderful adventure being able to sponsor people. I know one of them's in the room today. Hopefully I helped him out a little bit along the way. But helping other people has been what it's about. I don't want to do it most of the time. I don't know who does. People call you in the middle of the night. They want help. Like, I just want to sleep in the middle of the night. But it's something that we need to do. The book is full of it, talking about that was it. That was the program of recovery, was about running around and helping other people. And I was taught that early on. And it's not always a happy deal. If you've had a chance to sponsor people, it's not always a quote-unquote success. What would I deem a success? Somebody who's still sober today. Is that the definition of success? Absolutely not. Like, did you share moments with that person? One of the men I sponsored, second guy I ever sponsored, we had just gone through step 9 or step 8, talked about his amends list, and I had set him loose on the world to make amends. And it was just the next day, and I was driving home, and he called me, and he said, I can't believe it. I just talked to my mom on the phone. I hadn't talked to his mom in years, 8 or 10 years. I don't know how long it had been. He said, I just talked to my mom, and we're having lunch tomorrow together. Now, that makes you pull the car over if you have to. You know, that stops you in your tracks when stuff like that. When you can be part of that, I'm the guy who lived in an abandoned house. I'm the guy who didn't want anything to do with the world, with his children, with anybody except for myself. And I'm available and I'm there for stuff like that. I wish, was that a success? Absolutely. In that moment, it was a wonderful thing. It's unfortunate that years later, then we had to console that mother because that gentleman took his own life. In sobriety, he couldn't live anymore, and it took his life. But being available for people. Sometimes it's funny. I remember getting a 12-step call. I was outside a meeting on a Sunday night, and a friend of mine, somebody I had been working with, called me, and he said, yeah, I just got a call from somebody who, I put my name on a phone list. First of all, I can't believe he got called off of a phone list, you know? How often does that happen? But he said, this guy called me and he needs help. And I was like, well, you know, I'm just going into a meeting. And he's like, I thought you said we're supposed to help people every chance we get. And I'm like, oh, God, I did say that. I'm like, all right, come pick me up. And we went and met this guy, and he was rip-roaring drunk. And his air conditioner was out because he didn't pay his electric bill or something. And he was sweating booze and he was hugging us and he was so happy we were there to help him. And I couldn't tell you what happened to that guy. But when me and the other guy I came with left that building, we were walking on clouds. We had seen a program of action in action. And that's a wonderful thing. So sobriety's given me a lot of things. I have a wonderful job today. I'm blessed to be able to work in the field that I learned a long time ago. At the low part of my drinking, I was unemployed at times, but I was the night clerk at a hotel in Oxford, Mississippi, because that's the only job I could get. And I was stealing English muffins from their breakfast buffet, taking them home. I remember my uncle came to visit me. We were in Mississippi. My uncle came to visit, and instead of just putting him in my little apartment, I was going to be a big man. I got him a room at the hotel. I didn't pay for the room, but I just scanned the little card and I said, here, you got a room on the house for the night. Well, the next morning he calls the apartment. He said, the police are here. They're going to arrest me for being in here illegally. And, I lost that glamorous job as a night clerk at the hotel. But today I'm a good employee. I have a good job. I have a roof over my head. I have a wonderful wife that I'm just blessed every day to have. I have relationships with my children today. We talk about my son asking me that question, on that Monday in January 2007. And, unfortunately he's had to fight his own demons. He's found out the answer to that question is not so easy. He's fought his own demons for a long time. About 4.5 years ago, his alcoholism and his drug use, brought him to commit a violent crime against the mother of his child. My granddaughter. I have 3 granddaughters now. But he committed that crime, and I was there by his side when he was sentenced to 4 years in prison, state prison. And I went through that with him. I wasn't in that cell with him, but I was in his. He was in my heart every day. I wrote him letters and I sent him books and I went to visit him and we talked about spiritual principles and we cried together. And I was there the day he got out 4 years later. And 3 months after that, he is burning his life to the ground again. And man, that'll break your heart. And if that doesn't tell you what an alcoholic and a drug addict is, I don't know what does. He had everything to live for. If you've ever met my granddaughter, some of you have. She comes every Saturday when she comes to stay over during the month. She's like, are we going to the meeting, Peepaw? Are we going to the meeting? So she's been to a lot of AA in her life. But to disregard that little girl, to throw your whole life I get so angry sometimes until I think, like, of course that's what you do when you're an alcoholic, when your alcoholism is untreated. So he just was picked up on Friday. He was on the run from the law until Friday. He got picked up by, I guess, the SWAT team broke in the door and they took him back to prison. Hopefully things go in the right direction now. But I guess if I don't need any lesson more than that to let me know how things are for an alcoholic, then I get that lesson every day. You know, time goes by. It's been 11 and a half years. Yeah, I was checking my watch. It's been 11 and a half years. It's been 11 and a half years. And there are times when I can forget those moments at the beginning, or they become a thing of the past, and I start to forget about it. I haven't been close to a drink in all that time. I've thought about it at times. We were just on vacation. We were blessed to be able to go on vacation. We were in Greece for 2 weeks. And they looked like they were having a good time drinking. And when we got done with our meal, they bring you free booze to the table. And the guy, we said, no, we don't drink. And he's like, don't worry about it. It's not strong. It's okay. And I think my wife said to him, she's like, you don't want us to drink, okay? It's not about what we want. But I'm able to enjoy life today. While the thought comes and goes sometimes, time goes by. And being asked to speak tonight, it helps me review that. I've spent the last couple days thinking about those early days, not with the shame and guilt that I had when they were happening, but with the hope and the joy. If there's anything, I thought about the last couple days. I just want you to feel what I feel. Like, if you're just new, getting sober, like, I just can't tell you how it feels to live life, to be able to live life and be happy, reasonably happy, almost all of the time, even when it's dark and even when it's bleak and things are happening, to be happy with who you are. I want people to feel that. And to be asked to speak gives me a chance to let people know that. So, I appreciate being asked to speak. I hope I was able to share something. If you're new, find somebody that knows this stuff. I think the group asks at the end of the meeting if there's people available. So you don't even have to guess if somebody's available. They're here. They're going to raise their hand. Ask them for help. If you've been sober a while and you're feeling miserable, find somebody. I was 6 months sober before I started to find some happiness in this program. I know people who've been 10 years, 12 years. I've sponsored guys who 8 or 10 years. They're looking for that happiness. Find somebody that can give that to you. Look at them and say, like, they look like they're a happy person. And they'll show you the way. The way is not always easy, but it's definitely the best road to take. That's it. Thanks.